Hi, welcome to the River Talk Podcast, a podcast where we talk about rivers, pretty straightforward, with my friends Eric Weisse and Priscilla Macy. I'm Zach Collier, and we have a really full show for you guys this week, tons to talk about, and we're going to try to do this in a reasonable amount of time. And just to get started, do you guys have any news of the week?
Not really news of the week. Well, I guess I do have news of the week. I started this week as the new executive director for Oregon Outfitters and Guides. So thanks to the board for selecting me, two of which who are on the podcast with me right now. But yeah, we're really stoked to start the work and kind of get the organization re-up and going.
Yeah, it's really exciting to finally have someone herding all the cats. This is going to be great.
Yeah, that becomes...
You have no idea what you've signed up for, but...
I know, you keep telling me that, but I'm stoked. The other thing I wanted to mention is on the last podcast, which I wasn't on, there was a discussion about whistle blasts and a comment that three whistles isn't really ever used and that it shouldn't maybe be used anymore. And so we on the podcast just wanted to say, again, a lot of what we talk about is opinions. And with the whistle blast, maybe it's not used in certain settings. Jacob and I talked about it, and Jacob's like, I at least have used it twice a year for the past few years, just because it's, you know, it's pretty distinct. Three is different from one, and it draws attention. So we don't want to discredit that as a tool. I've been looking myself through my old books to see what the standards are, not only in river running, but in other industries. And so if anybody listening has more information about standards of communication, please pass it along. It'd be pretty useful and interesting to discuss.
Yeah, it was interesting after the podcast, I did a bunch of research about this because I was kind of wondering, and Priscilla, you brought some things up about it. And I think the podcast last time was about standards. Do we even have standards? Like, and if there are standards, who decides them, right? There's no, like, a lot of this stuff we're just kind of passing on. And I always felt like three blasts meant, like, critical danger, which I think is good. Like, there's something really bad happening that could, like, lead to life or limb, right? That's a bad thing. And the more I read into it, I felt like in my reading, it was more about, like, I'm in danger.
Oh,
like the AW symbol. I found something on AW website that said, use it when you're in personal danger.
Interesting. So,
instead of like, I'm around a dangerous situation.
Yeah. Well, I've used it before when I've, you know, been in an eddy and someone swims, just like the three whistle blasts so that they know something's going on if they can't see it while I go, you know, to chase the person or the boat. I've definitely also used it. I'm trying to think. Like, you know, it's taking a fall on a portage where it's like, oh crap, I can't get myself back up. I need help. Someone, I guess it doesn't have to be three. It could just be a bunch of whistle blasts, but I think the three was ingrained in my brain back from whitewater rescue classes and like adventure leadership classes is I think where I originally derived that information. And then it just continued to be conveyed through a lot of the paddlers that I paddled with. So it would be really interesting to kind of look through what the standards are, what information is out there, if there are standards, and if there's conflicting information.
Well, we're super lucky to have Alan and Alicia on this week to help us with this, maybe. I know that Alicia is involved with the ACA. Maybe they have, like, a standard for that.
Great.
You know, the way I wouldn't use it if there's a swimmer. I'd blow one if there's a swimmer. Like, hey, attention. Where three would be, like, person trapped in a log. That's how I've sort of used it. Like, hey, I need everybody to drop what they're doing and focus on this thing. And so,
got it.
And like some of the reading I said was like, one is just like attention, look, pay attention to me. And then danger is like also just a bunch of whistle blasts. Like if you just need to get attention, just maybe not three, maybe just do a bunch.
Yeah.
Because people can't always hear whistles either. Like they're actually not as loud as we think.
Yeah.
So maybe three, if you blow three, people might hear one or two. And so just if you're in trouble, just keep, just blow.
That's a good point.
So that's why I like the podcast though, because we can talk through some of these things and like get different opinions. And again, there's not a standard, so it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think to Zach's point, I think about it in the way of like, what would, if I'm in the field and I heard, you know, three, four, five whistle blasts, like what is my reaction going to be? and it's going to be drop whatever I'm doing and run or get to where a place where I can see what's happening and figure out how I can help, because something is like not good. You know, it's, I'm not going to sit in my boat. I'm not going to, like, shit is hitting the fan, is sort of my interpretation of what I would do if I heard that. And so it's also going to guide when I would do that or what kind of situation I would do that with.
Yeah. So I just, talking about standards, I just found this and I just remembered this from this show I was watching. So looking at hunter safety, actually. So they say on Hunter Ed, the international emergency sign for distress is three signals of any kind. So three shots, three blasts on a whistle, three flashes with a mirror, or three fires spaced evenly. So that might be where the three was derived from.
Well, I mean, as I of course, it isn't it. I've heard six actually too, as I was reading more about this. Some people use six, but if you look in the rest of your books, a lot of them say three, a lot of them just say a lot of blasts. And I don't think to the standard, but I'm actually curious what Alicia has to think about this.
So yeah, let's
ask her in one of our millions of questions for her when I get her on the show here.
Can I just toss one out there? I've just thought I've had it. Is it possible that it stems from, and this is just me like conjecture, SOS in Morse code is like, was it long, short, long, or backwards? I don't know what Morse code, but it's three of the same, right?
Yep.
I wonder if that is sort of where this... anyone's a blast, a whistle blast, or rescue historian, let us know.
Track that person down.
It'd be a cool topic.
Other news of the week, you know, permit application season is either started or starting soon. January is the month for most of the stuff out there. So I believe anyway, is January. January is the like rec.gov month for most applications.
Cool. Yeah. Yep.
Get busy on those permit parties. Now's the time to start thinking about your summer, even though it's snowing.
It's really rough getting permits because a lot of permits from last summer got pushed onto this summer too. Like people were able to not go last summer because of COVID and then go. So, and more people want a boat, I think, because of COVID. So it's going to be super competitive for permits.
Yeah. The 2022 permits coming up for the grand, like, are going to be way down. I think the availability in the initial round of stuff is going to be way down, I think, for that reason.
Well, the only news of the week I have is, you know, I've been doing a lot of training with IRF, and I really feel like having people practice safety stuff is important. And so I got together with Trevor Croft at Rafting Magazine, and we're doing a little contest this month. Basically, just like go out and film yourself trying to do a raft flip drill according to the IRF standard and submit it to Trevor, and there's prizes. It's just something fun to encourage training, encourage people to get out and practice stuff. And so I'll put a link on the website. And I'm sure we'll talk about it more. So that's the only news I have. Let's get to our first guest. I'm pretty excited. I'm going to bring on Robert from Karmic Outdoors. And last week we talked about this product they have, which is a sticker you can put on your gear. And if you lose it, it can get returned to you. And Robert was nice enough to join us. Are you there, Robert?
I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. Do you have a minute just to give us a quick history of the company and then kind of what you guys do?
Yeah, I got all the time in the world, man. Karmic Outdoors is, well, the first, it's sort of a play on words. Karmic is a play on karma and river karma and all that stuff. And, you know, if you do a good deed or a bad deed, it's a karmic deed. And so it could either be a good deed or a bad deed. We just kind of give you the availability or the option to do the good deed, which is to return the lost or found gear to the rightful owner. So this all started a few years ago. I was fly fishing. We're out of Boise, Idaho, and I was fly fishing one of our local rivers, and I found a fly rod, and I really wanted to get it back to the owner. So I got home, and I posted on social media, posted on Craigslist, posted on, you know, all kinds of different outdoor forums, and I got a lot of responses, but I didn't get any from the one fly rod I had in my hand. You know, you think of like, well, how much stuff have I lost in my life? I've lost, you know, half a dozen fishing nets and fly boxes and paddles and just like all kinds of stuff, and I'm sure everybody listening has lost something of value in the outdoors. And some of that stuff is sentimental. Some of that stuff is irreplaceable. You know, like you probably have your favorite piece of gear that they just don't make anymore. And like, you can't replace that. So anyways, we saw this as a huge problem in the outdoor industry, and there isn't really any good solution right now. The best solution currently is the Sharpie, right? Like most people just have like the Sharpie that doesn't work very well, or like, you put your phone number, which you forget the area code, or like I went rafting with a dude and he had his name on all of his gear. Like everything he had had his name on it. And it's like, what am I supposed to do? Like get back to Boise and be like, are you John? Are you John? Are you like it didn't give me any valuable information. So we solved all these problems with our decals that are, they're extremely durable decals. They're military grade construction, so they don't scratch or chip or wear off. They can sit in salt water for years. They can sit in the sun for years. Like these things are hardcore. And so all of your personal information is stored safely in our database. So it's the link between your gear and you is our decal, stored in a secure database through our every single decal has a unique QR code and a unique ID number. And so that just sort of is the nexus between the gear, the person, and the information that can get shot to whoever finds the item.
So I got some of these. They're pretty cool. And I didn't know how I'd use them until I started walking around my garage. And so for me, I put some on my kayaks, my hardshell kayaks, thinking if I swim and my kayak goes 5 miles downstream, somebody might find it. Like that seems like a good use of it. Or yeah, a paddle. Like if my paddle goes downstream, I put on my paddle too. And when people find it, do they then scan the QR code?
Yeah. So we actually have two ways of doing that. So we have our website on there. And then when you go to our website, it says, you know, return lost gear or, you know, return gear. And then you just enter the ID number on our website. Or the easier way is to just bring up your smartphone's camera and hover over the QR code. And it links you right to that page to enter that information, and all that auto populates already for you if you just use the QR code. So we tried to make it as simple as possible for the finder to get your gear back.
And then the finder, it says get reward. So I'm thinking, okay, cool, reward.
Yeah.
Where does that reward come from? Do you guys make that reward, or does it come from the person who you found their stuff?
Yeah. So if you buy a Karmic decal, we're going to include a return incentive. So it says reward, whether you want to give the person a reward or not, we're going to give them some decals to say thank you for doing that. And, you know, hopefully they're excited to get those because they just noticed that this product worked. So we give them free decals. We're going to put them in for a monthly drawing for a prize pack, an annual drawing for a big prize pack. And then since we're Karmic Outdoors, we gave you the option of good karma or bad karma. So hopefully you just inherited some good karma. And then lastly, you can certainly reward the person if you want. You know, like if you want to give them a high five, you want to take them out for a day of guided trips, if you want to give them a Bud Light, like whatever you want to give them, go for it. Like, but we are going to provide you a return incentive program that you don't have to buy into.
And then how does shipping work? Do they just figure it out? You like just contact the person like, hey, dude, ship a UPS, I'll pay you back. Is it pretty much
generally? Yeah, we don't have any kind of like shipping, so that's going to be on you. Like if you go to Alaska and you go fly fishing in Alaska and you lose your fly rod, like, you know, just to work with that person to get it back. Yeah, we don't offer any kind of shipping yet.
I'm just kidding. These are the things I was curious about, and we had no idea about it. So let me tell you the things I marked. I marked two kayaks, a paddle. I marked one of my skis. Like, what if your skis get lost? I don't know if I lose skis or not. And then I put one on my favorite coffee cup.
Yeah.
Because I always lose my favorite coffee cup and it's expensive.
Good point.
Hoping somebody will return it. I don't know. I'm just curious to see how it works.
Yeah.
Is this just for outdoor gear? Like, can I put this on my laptop?
Put on anything you want, man. It works on anything. I have one on my phone, my laptop, my AirPod case, like anything that you value. Like, we are branding ourselves as an outdoor gear company. Mm-hmm. But outdoor gear, people have keys, phones, wallets, photography equipment, like whatever you want. Yeah.
Cool.
How long you been doing? How long has this been in place? Like, how long has this been happening?
Yeah. We recently launched in 2020, the summer of 2020. So it's been a pretty wild ride recently. But you know, we've been working on this for a little over a year. Designing everything and contemplating everything, but you know, we've officially been launched since about July.
And you know, I'm sure you probably have some analytics on this because you can see, you know, how many scans you've had or how many people have arrived on pages for equipment stuff. What kind of, I mean, are you guys Is it being used? Service hours? Yeah. Is gear getting back to people?
We haven't had a official lost and found scenario yet. We've had people testing it and trying it. You know, like, of course, when I got the decal, I tested it to see if it worked, right? But we haven't had a lost and found scenario yet, and I cannot wait for it to happen. It's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, maybe
it totally makes sense. I think of like a bunch of things that I've lost that this would have probably helped. Like I left my kayak helmet on my car and drove off, you know, and if I'd had one of these stickers, I bet I would have gotten it back.
Right. Yeah. So
it's super cool. You know,
the majority of outdoor people are good people. You know, they want to get your gear back to you. And if you go to any forum, you're going to see hundreds of people with lost and found, and people want to get your gear back. They want to return your phone. They want to return your wallet. They want to return your skis, your kayak paddle, whatever. You just got to give them the opportunity, and that's what we're here for. And just one last thing, you know, we've partnered with Sawyer Paddles and Oars. So when you purchase Sawyer Paddles and Oars, you're going to have the option of having our product built into theirs. So instead of, you know, having it customized where you put your name and phone number in the paddle, therefore making it yours forever, our Karmic decals are going to be on theirs when you upgrade to that. And then you can deregister that, and then the new person can register that. So it's a selling point or an upgrade feature. So I just wanted to mention that real quick, you know, because this is a whitewater rafting community.
Yeah, I mean, you could also not deregister it, and then if the person you sell your oars to, them, you get them back.
That's nefarious. We do not condone those behaviors.
Yeah, that's bad karma.
And then, you know, if anybody's listening to this and they enter the code KARM, K-A-R-M 25, and you get 25% off.
Sweet, sweet.
Yeah.
We'll have that. We'll have that on our website.
That'd be great. Thanks, guys.
Cool. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. So we're going to bring on Alan and Alicia from Canyon River Instruction here. I'm super excited to talk to them. We do a lot of rafting instruction, and they're doing a lot in Colorado. And one of the tricks with rafting instruction is that there's not standards really. Like there's not like one way of doing things. And so we teach things a certain way, we believe, and I'm sure they teach things their way, but we don't all get a talk. So I'm excited to get their take on a lot of things rafting related and instruction related. So with that, I'm going to bring him here. Welcome to the show, Alan and Alicia.
Hey.
Hi, hello.
I just did a quick intro. The first thing I want to know is like, tell us about your business, what you guys do.
Sure. So we're a paddle school, but we're a rafting company. But okay, so what we do is kind of interesting. We are licensed like any normal rafting company, but we don't actually take commercial guests downstream. And we're not your typical paddle school because we're not focused on hard shells, which most paddle schools are. We do, you know, we do a little bit of hard shell stuff. We do some kayak and canoe, stuff like that. But 90% of what we do is rafting and river safety. So, you know, we get a lot of folks who are wanting to learn how to row or wanting to learn how to R2. And like I said, we do a lot of river safety stuff too, from full-on swiftwater rescue for professionals to just basic like kids river safety stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what we have found, over the years, just boating and privately and working professionally on the river is that we would see, an always increasing number of, you know, private boaters out there, very well-meaning private boaters out there who are getting into taking their families downstream, who want to do some maybe multi-day river camping along the way, whatever it might be. And, you know, and these are folks who are realizing as they're getting into it, you know, maybe they had they went on a commercial trip some years ago, they have some friends who know what they're doing, but, you know, they realize that instruction is, like anything else, is very important. And they also see the value of, you know, like taking a hunting safety class, you know, that value of just putting the investment of their own time and skill into it to, you know, to bring a safer attitude towards the river when they're taking their family downstream or their friends or whatever it might be. And so, yeah, we found that there are, you know, really quite a lot of individuals out there and a lot of families, really, that are pretty excited about it.
Yeah. And one thing that I noticed during just my guiding career was that every single guide school that I ever taught inevitably had 2, 3, maybe for people taking this guide school who were not interested in becoming guides. They were, you know, like Alan was saying, wanting to learn how to take their families rafting and had no other way of gaining these skill sets, because you could go take a kayak lesson, but it was hard to find a place to take a raft lesson. So they were taking a guide school. And while they were getting some of the skills that they needed, mm-hmm. really guide schools are designed to create guides. They're designed to create employees. They're often very insular. They're, you know, really designed to teach those employees how to memorize those rapids that they're going to be taking people on, and how to wash wetsuits at that company, and what company policy for cutting pineapples at lunch is.
Right. Like that. And so, you know, that's to say that those guide schools are very focused on
creating good guides.
Creating good guides on the particulars of that company, but not so much on the particular needs of the individuals taking the guide school. And so we wanted to flip that on its head. And so that's why most of what we do is really quite custom. So we try to meet our clients really where they are. If they've never been in a boat before, fabulous.
Or if they're wanting to step up to class 4 for the first time.
That's exactly why we started. We do rowing classes too. Yeah. We used to do guide schools, and it would be like half private boaters, half students. And it was a weird dynamic, right? It was like, it was meant to be a boot camp for guides, and people were there for kind of a vacation of learning. It was awkward for both parties. So we split it up into two. And then we realized like, we were getting way more people wanting the rowing classes and not as many people wanting the guide schools. So we stopped doing the guide schools.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah.
So same thing. Do you guys do mostly, because I know you do ACA raft guide training too. Do you do mostly private boater training or mostly like river guide training, or kind of both?
90% of our clientele are private boaters. And honestly, most of the river professionals we get are for swift water. In terms of, I know that the ACA is going to be a whole nother question topic that's going to come up, where actually the ACA is still in process of creating a guide certification. Right now, we still just have kind of the instructor thing, in the same way that ACA kayak instructors work. But like I say, we are in process of making that guide certification happen. Having said that, there are a number of rafting companies out there now who are utilizing the ACA instructor cert as kind of like a guide cert placeholder. It's kind of interesting. I know that you do the IRF thing, and that a lot of countries do the IRF thing, and some countries do the WRF thing. And like you were saying, just there's really no such thing as standards across the board. But you know, and like I say, in terms of how that ACA guide cert will end up translating, it will sandwich right in with the instructor certification, so that the people teaching guides, so that rafting companies can still run their own insular guide schools, so that their employees are learning the way that things are run at that company, and so that their, you know, senior guides can be teaching them, but then their senior guides will have gone through the ACA instructor process of learning how to teach. And that's really where the ACA shines, is in, you know, creating good instructors who have good teaching skills, not just good paddling skills, but good teaching. And so then rafting companies can have their own, like I say, their senior guides who have, you know, been trained in good teaching methods, who can then teach these guide schools while being able to hand out that certification that says, yes, these guys have checked off all of these check boxes and they can do all of these skills and they've been taught well. And I guess that was a really long way to say that at Canyon River Instruction, but like I say, 90% of our clientele are actually private boaters, and that's really our focus. But that we, you know, like I say, and me personally working with the ACA, I do work a little bit within kind of the commercial industry, but it's not CRI's focused.
The focus is private boater training and mm-hmm. like I think rescue training, right?
Yeah.
Mostly, yeah. definitely mostly private for rowing and those types of skills. Mostly private for swiftwater as well. Though it's interesting, I've worked with quite a few folks from our local. We have some Air Force bases in here in Colorado in the area, and they will have outdoor rec programs. And so sometimes the leaders of those outdoor rec programs want to come and brush up on their swiftwater skills too. So, interestingly, we've worked with quite a few of those folks too.
Yeah, and we get guides just coming to do their research and whatnot. But around here, swiftwater is not required, so we don't get a ton of guides, which is kind of weird.
It's not really required anywhere, I don't think.
Some rivers.
Do you know anywhere it's required?
There's no states, to my knowledge, that require it. Oregon and Idaho, we have to certify that, you know, our guides have, like, we state that you have some sort of skill set in that area, but having like an SRT1 or something like that is not required.
And I think what I really want to do is I have some just fun questions I want to ask you guys, just like the standard, like, what do you do? What do you believe in questions? I just enjoy getting people's takes. So the first one, are you guys into pins and clips or oarlocks?
No, I'm not going to completely badmouth pins and clips.
All right, that's enough of an answer.
Go for it.
Yes.
Go for
it.
They have their time and place. Some people love them. That's cool. I don't like them.
Yeah, I have to agree. I've never been able to get into them.
But I will say that I love convertible or rights as a teaching tool. Just because you can have a fixed blade for a new student who, you know, that's one less thing for them to have to think about. And then you can flip it up when they're ready to try feathering or, you know, when I need to jump on the oars or whatnot. I love feathering. I like having, you know, full control over being able to feel the current with my oars and use different angles. And but yeah, like I say, I'm definitely an advocate of the convertible or right as a teaching tool. I think it's pretty fabulous.
I'm not sure why everybody doesn't have convertible or rights, right? Like, why not have them?
They're brilliant.
Yeah.
They work. You know, the only thing I would say is I've gotten to the point now where I actually like to have my oars completely free. I'll move the donut up a good ways up the oar shaft. Mm-hmm. I can have it there as a backstop. If I get pitched, you know, to one side, I can kind of catch myself. But when I'm sitting there rowing, I'm totally free. I'm totally off of that donut. And I actually had been rowing for years and went up and took a class up in Oregon and saw that for the first time. I had never noticed anyone rowing that way before here in Colorado.
It was your instructor certification.
It was actually. Yeah. And started trying it and just kind of fell in love with that totally free technique.
Yeah.
It's super popular with drift boat guides. Yeah. So they can it keeps their handles further out of their way when they let go of their oars. So if you're like jumping around, pulling fish, that kind of stuff, your handles are more out of the way.
I tend to definitely like it. I think when I've been rowing a gear boat and you're just kind of in the sitting pushing, not the standing pushing, I don't mind having the backstops next to the oar locks. But generally when I'm rowing, I find myself wanting them free and kind of pulled tight. But there's certainly scenarios we've talked about on the podcast before where it's like bigger, pushier water. I could see myself possibly liking pins and clips. I've never tried them. I've never had a huge issue with not having them, but I'd be open to trying them if I didn't have to buy them.
We don't need to go down that path that hard, but I'm an advocate, as you guys probably know. Which guys I'm talking about is having the donut really far out so you can move the oar in and out pretty freely. Mm-hmm. And it's become quite the rage lately, especially with our guides. We're calling it insies and outies. So when you have no oar rights, it's spinnies. And then when you move them out, we're calling it insies and outies. And I personally think it just makes it really hard. But I rode with one of my friends, one of the guys I work with, and he rode the wind the other day with insies and outies and did awesome. So I'm starting to think about trying it more.
I definitely think it's fun. I kind of like playing with it. How I had kind of always set up my oars, even before I discovered this, you know, fun thing of in Z's and Audis. I would always set up my donuts so that I could row on them, but without having my hands too far apart so that I'm still very centered. But then I can also easily bring them in and row even more centered when I need. And I just found that was naturally probably kind of how I've always rowed, is, you know, sometimes on them and sometimes off of them, but having them set up so I can easily do either. So, yeah.
Well, mentioning like moving them in, I'm asking about oar placement. How do you, like, I think there's a lot of debate about oar placement. Like, do you want your oars to touch when they're low? Do you want them far apart? Like, how do you guys feel about oar placement?
Absolutely. So this is one I actually feel pretty strongly about. so many people, you know, there's the standard kind of the old codgers going, oh, you got to have two fists between your oars, otherwise you'll knock your thumbs. And I'm going, no, you just have to learn to row with cadence. Then you won't knock your thumbs. But really, you know, when you think about body mechanics, you actually have way more power rowing from a more centered position. You know, and I know people who will go so far as to row with a full handle overlap. And I've certainly found that when I'm in the middle of making a big move, I'm quite unintentionally in a, you know, almost a full handle overlap, just because that's where that power is coming from. But in general, like, you know, when I'm teaching, I'll usually set it up so that there's, you know, enough of a gap where the students aren't going to be knocking their thumbs, because, you know, it can suck. It's like, it does smart. It's like, ah.
Right. I was going to add that too, that, yeah, we definitely teach the more, maybe, you know, safer for new oarsman technique, where you can have the gap there so you don't knock your knuckles. But I do definitely encourage our students as they progress to try to pull the oars in a little bit and see how that goes.
Do a little bit of an overlap. And I find that for me personally, I end up, my kind of sweet spot where I row often is probably just a couple inch overlap, like maybe an inch or two. But again, you know, I'll end up pulling them in when I need, or, you know, a little further out sometimes.
I'm curious to hear what your take on that is.
I agree with all of that 100%. I row an inch or two overlap generally. I find on the river a lot of people I see are rowing way too far apart, and they're not using their muscles well, and they're not getting leverage on their oars. Like, I'll jump in that boat and just like, how do you row this thing down river? And so I feel like there's so much advantage from having more interior oar length.
You know, the other really big one too is just shoulder injury. I mean, just in terms of, when it comes to hard boat skills, people talk about the paddler's box all the time, and that so rarely gets translated to rafting. But it's the same thing whether you're guiding a paddle raft or rowing an oar boat. You still want to stay in that paddler's box, and you don't want to get your shoulders out into that red zone. Whereas when you're pushing an oar all the way out here, you're automatically in that red zone of shoulder injury danger. So it's so much on your shoulders and easier on your body, and you get more power out of each stroke by being a little more centered.
Yeah, I think one person once hurt their thumb, and all of a sudden that became the rule. You got to have a thumb width apart. Like, it maybe happened one time.
Right.
Like, it's, I don't know, I run overlapping all the time, and it's not a problem for me.
Yeah, I think I've taught like hundreds of people how to row, and I've always taught to overlap your hands, and I don't think I have ever seen or even heard of someone like hitting their hands on each other.
Yeah,
but maybe, you know, we have your rivers or something. I don't know. I've never even thought about that. But I can see it now that you're mentioning it. Now I'll go out next time and smack my thumbs, I'm sure. So,
no, if you're already rowing with a good cadence, you won't.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Well, let's keep moving. I got a bunch of things I'm asking you about. Are you more cap boaters or what we call round boats, like rafter or cap boaters?
So I actually grew up on a cat. My dad was a private boater. He had a 17-foot cat when I was growing up.
And weirdly, I've never had the pleasure of really rowing a good cat. So I've just stuck to donuts.
I definitely, you know, in general, I find round boats just so much more versatile. Cat boats are a ton of fun. But definitely donuts give you the versatility of being able to row it or use it as a paddle boat. They definitely, as gear pegs hold a lot more. So, you know, kind of our standard has always been donuts around here, but we got, we definitely, you know, I have students come to me with their own cat boats, and we've had enough inquiries of people wanting to learn to cat boat that don't have them yet, that it's, we would have gotten one for this year if COVID hadn't totally derailed last year. But for the 2022 season, don't worry, we'll get you a cat boat.
No good.
I mean, a 17-foot gear hog is one thing, but like a little 12 or 13-foot, like class 4 or 5 boat is so fun.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Especially if you come from a kayaking background, it's just really fun to just move that thing around. They actually act a lot like a kayak.
I could see that. Yeah, we've got a little 10.5-foot high side mini max. So we've got a little frame for, and that thing's just like a toy when you're out there rowing it. It's so fast, and I can imagine that the cat, a small cat, would be even more so. So
yeah.
Yeah. And so forgiving. And we next, I want to ask you about pushing versus pulling. I feel like in our teaching, there's all this debate among instructors whether you should teach more pushing or more pulling or a combination of the two. How do you guys feel about that debate?
You know, I'm kind of right down the middle on that one. I think teaching that fairly evenly, but giving people a good idea of when one is appropriate and when it might not be. I think that's a more of a holistic approach. You know, on here in Colorado, we have a lot of low volume rivers. People are not super on technical, really pushy water all the time. And so, you know, not that pulling should be your only method, but it is certainly a very valid way of approaching a lot of those moves in lower water. But, you know, I think people need to be able to square up and push forward too and cut a line that way. So, like I say, I like to teach both. And I will say too that the other great thing about pulling is that if you are in big water, like on the Grand Canyon, you can turn backwards and powl and just pull downstream through those really big moves.
Whoa, that's new to me. We call that the downstream ferry. Yes. You guys are calling that powling.
Powling. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a new one. New terminology for me. Like,
I've never heard that. Yeah.
Well, my
one of the new things.
One of it is that when Powell actually, and those early wooden boats and those early river runners were going down those big Western rivers, that's how they had to do it. They would turn around and just pull and just crank down river through everything. And they would even have a spotter on the, I guess, stern, which is going first, yes, of the boat, kind of helping them call out what move they needed to make, and even throwing in a rudder from time to time.
Yeah.
But that was just the way they did it, I think.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. I find that in general, I noticed that private boaters tend to do a lot of pulling, and commercial boaters tend to do a lot of pushing. And that really kind of boils down to commercial pace. You know, when you're on a commercial trip, you're push, 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 push. You got to get back for your double dip or your triple dip or whatever. And when you're private boating, you've got all the time in the world. You're out there enjoying yourself. And having grown up as a private boater on oars, I, you know, learned pulling. But then training as a young guide, I also learned pushing. And I realized kind of partway through my career that, you know, I'll do a lot more back ferrying in a paddle raft than most guides will. And I'll do a lot more pushing in an oar boat than most private boaters will. And like Alan was saying, just having that holistic approach of knowing when, you know, when is appropriate to use one or the other, or when you could do either. And then also certainly, like I say, the, you know, downstream ferry kind of powell maneuvers on big water is huge. And it's usually pretty mind blowing for people. It can also be really intimidating for people to turn around and go into a big rapid. Yeah. You know, like one of the best examples of that is Horn Creek. Like, you know, Horn Creek in the Grand Canyon always inevitably at the Scout instills the fear of God in at least one person on your trip. And then, you know, you're telling them, no, really, I promise you want to enter this one backwards. And they're going, no, I don't. And you're going, yes, you do. And then, you know, once you kind of explain to them that that's your strongest stroke, that's where all mm-hmm. of your power is, and that, you know, and you explain to them all the power of that current. And once you combine those, that's your best bet. That's where you have the most power, is when you are utilizing the power of the current and your best stroke together. Yeah. And then that's when you can make those really big moves and bust over the those big laterals and things like that.
What do you folks see more up in the Northwest? Or do you?
I think the same. I mean, I think the what you're saying about private boaters generally pull and commercial guides push is a huge generalization. I think commercial guides push because they know the river. It's easier to push when you do it every day, you have it memorized. You don't need to pull. I think pulling is more defensive. But yeah, I think a combination of the two, or if you have a commercial guiding background, you like the idea of pushing. If you learn technical, you learn pulling. So a little bit of both. I think what's interesting thing about this talk though is I on mountain bus sometimes just reading articles or what people say, and a lot of people get annoyed by private boaters get annoyed by the other people pulling. You know, like they're going to a rapid and the person in front of them pulls. And so I think a lot of private boaters who are really good get super annoyed at boaters who can't push. I'm sorry, did I say that right? Like there's a lot of people who've been around forever, and then if the person in front of them pulls, it's very frustrating. So I feel like there's a whole set of private boaters that are like, you always push.
Well, I think there's a little bit more to that, because I've been the person that's been wildly frustrated behind someone. But I think there's a couple pieces. Like, one, on the guide standpoint, a lot of times we're rowing heavier boats. And especially on big rivers, you can't fight the current. Like, I can slow down a 14-foot private boat. I can throw the brakes on, pull upstream, pull away from things, like do the point at danger and pull away. Like, that's totally realistic in a 14-foot private boat. And a lot of times, super unrealistic in an 18-foot commercial gear boat. Like, I can fight the current all I want, and it's not going to slow me down a quarter of a mile an hour. So like I have to push, I have to downstream ferry, because those are literally the only options, like physically with the product that I have. So when I've got somebody in front of me in a lineup in a rapid, it's like throw the brakes on, and I'm in this tool that like that's wildly hard. I've been there.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
I've Absolutely. Been internally cussing people out for sure. And I think for us, you know, you talked about the Powling, you know, the Mackenzie drift boat was really one of the first boats where people rode facing forward going through rapids. And so up in the Northwest, that's kind of that like point towards danger and pull away in a light, nimble boat is sort of this ingrained culture piece. It feels like on the Rogue, that is the standard maneuver that everybody learned from their dad back in the day on a drift boat, and like what everybody does until they start rowing commercial weight boats, you know, full of people or stuff. And then that mentality changes pretty quick. For most folks.
Right.
Well, it's situational, like anything, like everything we do on the river.
You know,
I think that's why having all of those, all that in your bag of tricks.
You know, and part of that too, I think, boils down to river etiquette and just being aware of who's around you. And, you know, if you've got a commercial pod of 10 boats powering down on you, Eddie, and you know you want to pull all of the maneuvers in that next rapid, Eddie, out, let them go. You know, it, like I say, yeah, situational awareness and river etiquette, I think, is a huge part of that.
For sure.
That's a really important safety thing, too, to be able to pull away from danger and have that in your bag of tricks. And also just being the power maneuver, I tend to teach it first as well, just so that people can feel like, oh, I can move this boat.
Yeah. Let's keep going. Ideal throw bag length. This is this one catches up a lot of people.
For sure. And I think that's a really kind of personal and reverse situationally dependent kind of question. Like for me here on the Arc, it's not a very wide river, you know, and I carry a 50-foot bag, and that's perfect for the environment that I find myself in here. I don't know, Lish, you've got some other thoughts too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, personally, I know that throw bagging is not my strongest skill set. I mean, I can throw bag, I can hit my target, I practice it a lot. It's definitely something I've really worked at in my career. It's never one of those things that's coming easy to me. Like, I sucked at ball sports as a kid. I was like, I'm not a thrower. The only thing I can throw is a throw bag. It's because I've worked so hard at it. But like I say, it's not my strong suit. If I have somebody on my team who I know is a better at throw bagging, I will put them in the throw bag position and I will take another position of something that I have a stronger skill set at. So knowing that, I'm never going to attempt to throw a giant 75-foot roped bag, because I know that I'm less likely to hit my target with it, and then I'm never actually going to deploy that whole 75 feet. So for me, carrying a smaller, shorter, lighter weight bag, I'm way more likely to have a successful rescue by throwing... Sorry, I was touching my mic. I hope I didn't mess that up. by being able to deploy the whole bag and hit my target better. So again, like Alan was saying, can be a very personal thing. It can be a very river dependent thing, because I'm mostly on smaller volume rivers and I know I don't have a very strong arm. I know I'm best off with that lighter weight 50-foot bag.
Yeah. And you know, the craft plays into it too. Like I'm very happy with my 50-foot bag and my kayak, and I certainly don't want to carry a big, heavy, larger 75-foot bag and shove that into my kayak as well. So, you know, I think it just all depends.
Cool.
Yeah.
But 75-foot throw bags make great bow lines for when you're on really long beaches.
You can hang a lot of quite close in that foot line.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you said really resonates, is it's very situational and like, what are you going to be successful with? We often talk about that. It's like, what tools are you going to be most successful with? I'm kind of in the same boat as you. Is I know with my 50-foot bag, my NRS one, just the compact one or similar size, I'm going to be better at throwing. But if we're doing a trip where we're going to be doing boat lowers, or I know that 75 feet is something that is needed, like on a popular run in the Columbia River Gorge, the Big Brother Cave, having a longer rope, being able to reach that, I'll bring my bigger bag, but I certainly switch it up between the compact bag and the larger bag, depending on what I'm actually doing.
Awesome.
Absolutely. And I think for me in that situation, if I'm on a bigger river, I just add the bigger bag to my kit on the raft, but I've still got my smaller, lighter personal one with me all the time too.
Because
I know it, you know, and
if
you say, if that's the gear, you know, and you know that you can do a better job with it, you know, then that's the call to make.
For sure. Yeah. And in the last, go ahead.
No, just that I've always got my little one that I know I can throw. And then I often will add that bigger one for, like you say, certain situations. Yeah.
Yeah. So the last thing I think about too, that I don't think we brought up, is rope diameter. And so I also think about that, because my smaller rope is a smaller diameter. So for certain applications, it doesn't work as well. So that's just another, I guess, part of the equation as to what I'm going to bring.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the big things with rope diameter, obviously getting into using ropes for mechanical advantage is a whole another discussion. but in terms of simply rescuing swimmers, the smaller diameter rope is always going to be harder on the swimmer. You know, grabbing those little itty bitty ropes in the fanny pack throw bags, it sucks. Like it hurts your hand when you're the swimmer. But at the same time, if, you know, your thrower is more likely to get that rope to you, you're happy to have that rope, whether it's going to hurt your hand or not, in terms of grabbing it and holding on to it. And these are just, like I say, those kinds of things that you have to kind of weigh the cost and benefit and realize, you know, that, yeah, there's always going to be cost and benefit one way or the other, and weighing that and making those decisions, which, you know, when it comes to the little fanny pack ones, I tend to, because I know that that's harder on the swimmer, I tend to use that one less often than, like you say, just the regular NRS compact that has a little bit, you know, larger diameter. But I also know that if I throw, you know, one of the big ones that's the most comfortable on the swimmer's hands, I'm much less likely to get the rope to them. So yeah.
There's so many trade-offs here. It's so hard. And I think we all are boating a lot. And so we get like, oh, well, I'm going out, I'm going to deal with this situation, I'll bring this exact length and diameter and size. But the average person who just owns one throw bag, we probably own several throw bags each, right? Because this is what we do. But the average boater who needs to buy just one throw bag, they're not going to buy four, right?
Right.
What do they get? Like, do you guys have a brand recommendation or a length and diameter? Is there something you guys would suggest for just the average rafter?
Oh, my recommendation is throw them. Like, seriously, like, go to the floor and throw – like, you don't have to deploy them. Just throw them around. See which one you feel most comfortable throwing.
That's interesting.
Like, you feel you would be most accurate with. And then practice with it. You know, and that's the other thing. Even if you have, like, say someone – got you a throw bag as a birthday gift or whatever, and it's not necessarily the one that you would have picked out, practice with it. Practice, practice, practice. Just go out and throw it, because the more you throw it, the more you get used to it, the more likely you are to be accurate with it. And definitely, you know, when it comes to a one quiver throw bag, I'd say something middle of the ground, because, you know, you don't want the teeny tiny one, because that's so situational dependent. And then you don't want the giant one, because that's also situational dependent. So, you know, that nice, like we were talking, that, you know, NRS compact 50 footer is a pretty good middle of the road, will work for most circumstances, right, kind of thing.
That'd probably be my go-to to recommend to somebody as well. You know, with that rope, I probably wouldn't want to set up a big Z drag to pull a gearboat off of something that was, you know, really stuck. But at the same time, I mean, back to your question, if someone's asking you for a recommendation for their first one rope, they're probably not setting up that Z drag anyway.
Yeah.
And it's better for them just to have the equipment and to know how to use it and to know how to be effective in a basic rope rescue.
And to practice throwing it.
I love the emphasis on practice. Like, it's something that takes practice on shore and on the river too. Like, just go out and make your friends swim and pull them in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you guys have a favorite raft brand? I'm just super curious. I'm always trying to learn about brands and types. Do you have a favorite one that you like the most?
I'm an Air girl.
Awesome.
I love Airs. And I know that Airs tend to be either you love them or you hate them kind of thing. And for me personally, the extra weight at the takeout, or whether that's, you know, weight in water as you're pulling the boat up, or waiting in time as you're waiting for the water to drain, it's worth it, because they track so well on the water and they're so stable.
They're just burly too. You like can't kill them.
Yeah. I've definitely been in situations where I was so incredibly grateful to have that, you know, double layer with the bladder inside. I've definitely herniated some Airs in some pretty remote areas. So yeah, I personally really, really love Airs. Probably, and I just like the way that PVC performs too. Probably my second choice of boats would be High Sides, just because I like, you know, they also perform well. I love my Mini Max. It's lightweight. I roll it up and fly all over the world with it. It's super versatile. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I'm a diehard Air girl. Sorry, Moravia.
I mean, everybody makes good boats. It's just like, there's definitely preference based on your paddling. So
yeah,
that's right. Good to hear.
Right. It's like days, you know, people say, what's the best boat? And then it's almost like there is not a best boat. It's what fits you the best. It's what fits how you use it and where you use it the best.
Yeah. I'm pretty convinced the OG is the best boat ever made. That boat is unbelievable. I'm going to give it that. And I know you're going to call me a Waka bro and make fun of me, but like it's an amazing boat.
So I really want to paddle one. I haven't had the opportunity to yet because there are not a ton of them out here in Colorado. Although, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this, but I've definitely seen a lot of them, well, a handful of them break in Colorado. And so I just...
Yeah, boats break.
I question... Say what?
Boats break.
Boats break. It's, boats break.
They don't make boats like they used to. I think that's the answer to that. I mean,
so some break less than others, though. Like some,
I was with Priscilla when I saw two Jacksons. I saw two Jacksons break on the same day. So, I
mean, oh, that's normal. We have a good warranty, though. That's why we keep paddling them.
One of my friends just broke the front of her Piranha at BZ a couple days ago. So, boats. Yikes. I think that boats aren't made as well as these. I mean, all boats are breaking nowadays.
Yeah, yeah, but you're pretty happy with the plastic on the Waka boats.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't paddled it that much or that hard yet. I just like paddling it. It's just fun, and it paddles so well. But so we're digressing. Sorry, I just had to put that in there. I want to move on. We're running out of time. I have a couple more questions I want to get to. You know, we talked on the last episode a lot about whether to call high side or train high side or train over left, over right. And it was a really interesting discussion. And want to get your thoughts in terms of like teaching guides to train their crews. Do you like the command high side or would you consider going to over left, over right? Any thoughts about that?
So I actually have a really interesting story about this. I'm going to preface it, though, by saying that it's all about communication, and it doesn't really matter what it is that you train your guests to, as long as you're consistent with your commands. So I was 19 years old. I was working on the rivers in Scotland, and the company that I was working for there used jump left and jump right. And, you know, I'm a high side gal. I'd always said high side. It was what I grew up with. It was what I trained with. It was, you know, what my brain automatically goes to. And we were on the River Aa, which is the shortest little river in Scotland, but a fun little river. And anyways, in the first little rapid, I wound up, you know, the boat in front of me was playing hide the rock and I didn't see it. And in the split second that it took my brain to translate high side into jump right, you know, and at this point, like I hadn't actually trained my guests. It was, you know, the trip leader who had given the safety speech and said, you know, jump left, jump right. And, you know, all that season, it never really occurred to me. It's like, oh, well, I can say jump left, jump right. Like, I don't need to retrain my guests to high side. Well, apparently I did. Because, like I say, in that split second that it took my brain to translate high side right into jump right, we were wrapped really good. It was my first time wrapping a raft. And so, like I say, that was probably the first time that it really got me thinking about that need to communicate and be consistent with those communications. And like I say, even though I had thought to myself, oh, I don't need to retrain my guests to high side, obviously I also hadn't retrained my brain to jump left, jump right. And so I think that this actually is probably a broader topic that goes to all kinds of river communication and making sure that everybody's on the same page and that everybody knows what the commands are. So yeah, like I say, I don't think it's necessarily which one you use as long as everybody knows what it is and you're consistent with it.
Yeah, that definitely ties into what you guys were talking about at the top of the show about the consistency and the standards. You know, I think international standards is a whole nother ball of wax, but for here in the US, it seems to me that high side, if I was going to pick that, the high side command is the standard answer that people would be looking for.
And you can still say left or right. I mean, I add left or right to my high side.
Yeah, I mean, I think internationally high side's the standard too. Aaron, who guided on Cherry Creek for a long time and has guided all over the world, is just adamant that high side is lame and that over left, over right is way more effective. And I think I get that it's more effective if you train your crews for it. It's not everywhere. High side is just the thing. like everybody knows it. So it's like ingrained in the culture, in the current safety talk. So I feel like we have to change everybody's thinking. Although I get how over left, over right might be superior somewhat. It would be hard to change everybody to just change over left, over right.
I don't know. I'm going to play the devil's advocate here.
Do it. Awesome. I love when people disagree with Aaron.
I feel like over left, over right is something that doesn't have urgency to it. Like, you know, I feel like that's something that I would say if I'm like stuck on a rock at low water and need to low side off of it, I might be like, all right, everybody over right. You know, whereas high side is such a different word that people don't hear elsewhere. And especially
you can really yell high side.
Yeah. And if really, they've been trained to it in their safety speak, right? And suddenly you're yelling this new word that they've never heard before that means like, oh no, we're in trouble and we need to move fast. Like I would think that that word holds more power and urgency and would get people moving further faster.
I love it. I love it when people disagree with Aaron. I'm going to bring this up to him and see what he says. I'm torn. I'm a high side. I learned high side. That's what I've always done. All my safety talks, I talk about high side. I have a whole repertoire that I do that I like doing. And to change it seems like a lot of work to me because I have to change my way of thinking and everybody I work with and then, you know, a lot more people.
So compromise. That would be high side right, high side left.
I do like that. I'm going to bring that up to him too. I think we talked about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely what I do is I yell high side and then which side, because people are confused. They don't know which way is up and down in those scary moments. Yeah. They want direction.
I feel like there's also a piece of the conversation there around explaining to people why you're high siding. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, if they know ahead of time, like when we high side, we're always gonna be jumping towards whatever we're going to hit. You know, like you've prepped people. So that left right question, like you say high side, they're like, well, we're not there yet, but we're about to be, you know, and the boat's still not like up on its side. It feels like that pre-preparation and that communication ahead of time is really what's essential more than the left right piece. If you've done it right, done it correctly.
Absolutely. Well, and like I was saying, I think, you know, just that central communication in general, regardless of what your hand is, really is the key. You know, and it same goes for like everybody has different paddle commands. You know, some people are forward two all day long. I'm a forward stop kind of person. You know, again, making sure that you are training whoever is in your boat and being consistent with what you're saying. And that's really the bottom line, is making sure that you are communicating within your group effectively.
I love that. All right, we got to start wrapping this up. And I have more questions. We'll hopefully get you guys on again to answer more questions. But I think the last thing I want to talk about, we've talked about this before, is, you know, when boaters are new to boating, everybody says, take a swiftwater rescue course. Why don't we teach river safety to new boaters instead of rescue? And I think you guys teach a course like this. I'd love to get your thoughts about, like, what, when people are new to boating, what education should they have to be hopefully more preventative safety on the river?
Right. You know, I think really for all of our class, all of our safety courses that we teach, all of our swiftwater courses, whether or not we call it a 3-day swiftwater class or just a river safety basics class, the underlying idea is that preventative safety, right? You know, like what's the best river rescue?
The one that doesn't happen.
The one that doesn't happen.
Yeah. That's and how so, I feel.
Yeah. And so even for our really, you know, technical swiftwater courses, you know, I lead everything with how to prevent it from even happening in the first place. And that's kind of where all of our discussions start with from the beginning. And we'll even do, you know, several larger modules kind of on day one that is river safety that kind of helps, you know, cut off those swift water rescue scenarios before they even happen, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's how I prefer to teach people. And like you say, I think it, you know, there's a ton of information in those courses, and what people actually retain is probably a small fraction of that, you know, a week later. I'm sorry to say, but that's just kind of how I think the mind works, you know? So I think, yeah, if you can preface all that with just staying safe and being prepared from the get-go, I think that goes a lot farther.
Yeah. And definitely we do, like, you know, obviously the full, you know, 3-day swift water rescue aimed at professionals, whatnot, but also, like he was saying, you know, all of our courses are very safety and preventative oriented, and we'll do just 1-day river safety basics. We also, like, one of the things that we do is we work with the local city rec department to offer reduced priced river safety courses for kids. We have, just in our downtown zone, we have a whitewater park that is, you know, it's a great wee play park. We've got slalom gates and play holes and surf waves and whatnot, but it's also just absolutely inundated with children on inner tubes all summer. And, you know, some of these kids are from boating families and some of them are not. And, you know, so often you see kids out there without PFDs or trying to stand up, or, you know, it can be a little sketchy just watching the play park in the summer. So that's, you know, one of the community outreach things that we really try to do is promote river safety in the community, and especially for kids. And so, you know, we'll just take all these kids out on basically a 1-day raft trip and get them swimming and, you know, teach them super basics, you know, how to wear your PFD properly, wear it all the time, you know, how to do defensive and aggressive swimming, how to throw bag your friends, you know, simple little things. So it's, like I say, we're definitely very oriented in terms of those just river safety basics, I guess, and making sure that people have at least some of those basics. Like you say, not the big rescue stuff, which is fun, but that how to just...
It's definitely fun.
Yeah,
I think, you know, like, everybody wants to set up a Z rig, but not enough people want to learn, like, how to avoid problems.
Yeah,
right. I was gonna say too, if you can take someone who's new to the river and stick them in a class and teach them, you know, just a very simple way about how to throw a throw bag to their friends, and then how to just swim in whitewater.
Yeah,
so that they are safer. You know, they're gonna come out of an unintentional swim with a lot fewer bruises, I would wager, if they practiced it before. So I think if you can just, you know, teach somebody those real basic, you know, just how to throw something very easily and how to swim something and kind of what those concepts are. You know, I think that needs to be kind of a standard part of any intro to a rafting type of course or anything like that, even before a swift water rescue course would be.
And expedition mentality is something that we hound on a lot too, just, you know, being in the right mind frame and making good decisions. So, yeah.
We got to move on, I think. And we normally end with gear of the week. Do you guys have any gear of the week?
Go for it.
Sure, I've got one. One of my favorite pieces is the Everything Bag from Tough River Stuff. Tough River Stuff is a company right here in town that makes handmade river raft, like, rigging mesh solutions, mesh gear. So the Everything Bag is basically just a giant floppy bag made out of really burly multi-mesh material. And it has attachment points kind of halfway up the bag in strategically placed so that you can very securely attach it to the raft, to the boat itself, and to the frame, and, like, say, the rear well of the boat, of the raft.
Bow or stern. I like to run them both, bow and stern.
Yeah. And so what you can do is, the beauty of the thing is that instead of putting all of your dry bags and camp chairs and everything in the boat and tying them all or strapping them all down individually, you can just throw all this gear in one bag.
Propane bombs, kitchen boxes, tables, coffee cups, all of it. Your chacos, you throw all of it in there.
Yeah.
And then you just can cinch it up.
Yeah, you cinch up the top and tie it. Maybe put a couple of heavy straps across that to kind of hold it down. And that's rigged to flip. That thing's ready to go, man. We've flipped boats in Crystal, and those bags are perfect, and we don't lose anything out of them.
Yep.
So.
And then you're the first person done rigging in the morning.
Yeah, saves a ton of time.
Yeah.
Saves a ton of time because you literally have this bottomless well that you can just throw things into. It's great.
The thing looks really cool. Have you guys, Whitewater Worthy out of Southern Oregon makes a similar product called like the mushroom bag. And the different, the only difference with theirs is that it, like, when it comes up out of the well, it actually like kind of folds over the tubes a little bit. So you can go a little wider, whereas this one just kind of goes straight up out of the well. That one gives you, it's the same basic concept though, which I've never used, but for like private boating seems like it would absolutely be the way to roll. Like just throw all your shit in and strap and just like one strap and you're donezo. I kind of love the idea.
Pete loves these things, Eric. I think Pete uses them commercially. Yeah, he calls them the muffin top.
I do.
Yeah, muffin tops. I've heard that.
That's awesome. Nice. So I have a different piece of gear for the week. So I found this sunscreen that it's a mineral-based sunscreen. So it's both, you know, safe for your skin and safe for the river. And it has biodegradable glitter in it. I'm all about the sparkle and shred because, you know, glitter
is it?
But Echo Glitter is good because then it doesn't, you know, wind up in fish bellies and whatnot. So I have this saying that, you know, well, first of all, glitter promotes confidence because when you look good, you feel good. And when you feel good, you're more confident. And when you're more confident, you paddle better. And when you paddle better, you're safer. Therefore, looking good equals safer. So why wouldn't you put Echo Glitter in your sunscreen?
I'm down. Is it the brand called Unicorn Snot?
No, I've seen that one. I haven't tried it. It's
that one's awesome.
I forget what this one's called. You know what though? I'm not sure if the Unicorn Snot is the Echo Glitter. Is it the biodegradable?
It is. It is. Yeah. Yep.
Should try that one too. I sent Zach the link for this one. I forget what it's called. I like randomly found it in a kid's clothing store and I was like, oh, this is amazing.
That's awesome.
Love it.
I'll do my gear of the week really quick because I'm super excited about it.
Awesome.
I'm wearing it. It's called a bio pullover. And so it's like a hoodie thing, but listeners can't see this, but you pull it up. And it has a built-in mask. So it's basically just a hoodie and you just pulled up and you go shopping. You have a mask. And it's got like all kinds of filtration in there and stuff.
Nice.
So it's clothing that is now a mask.
So it's a long sleeve shirt that you're wearing with the hood and the cool mask attached?
Yeah, it's just like a hoodie. I'm a hoodie guy. But it doesn't actually have a hood. It just has this thing I pull up and I'm like now able to go to the store. Because I've been forgetting my mask a lot. And so my punishment when I, especially on shuttles, I've been the worst at remembering my mask on shuttles. So I've been putting my head out the window a ton on the drive. So I feel like if you don't have a mask, your head goes out the window. And so now I'm going to wear this under my dry suit and I take it. I can just hold up and I'm ready to go. I don't have to remember my mask. So I think I can get this whole neck thing under my dry suit.
Cool.
You guys always laugh at me. This is genius.
I'm not saying it's not. I thought you were wearing a scarf, like classic.
I did too.
It looks like a scarf. It's class. I think it's classy looking.
Of my gear of the week, I just picked up a DJI Mavic Air 2.
Oh, awesome!
And it's rad. Like, and it's way cheaper than the old Mavic Pro. It's like $500 cheaper, but you know, if you don't need the super super high quality camera, which that I've just been playing with it and the film quality, even shooting it like 1080 or 1080 or whatever letter they chose after it is unreal. Like it's super cool. It's easy to fly. It won't let you crash it into stuff, at least going forward, backwards or down, which solves a lot of problems. It's been really fun. The automated stuff on it it's crazy. Like it's super cool. The editing software it comes with for making quick things is awesome. I've been playing with it, skiing and snowmobiling. I'm excited to try it out boating here in the very near future too.
Awesome.
So, fun toy.
Mine is another warm layer. I got these Eddie Bauer jogger pants, but they are fleece lined and then like water resistant on the outside. So they're basically like fancy sweatpants, but I went hiking around in the woods this past weekend and it was pretty wet. And I was pretty stoked when I got back to the car that the inside fleece layer was still dry, even though I had been running around kind of through the mud and the wet. And so, yeah, stayed warm and dry. I'm pretty excited about them.
What's the outside of them?
It's like it's water resistant. I don't know what the material is. It's like if you imagine just like the standard like biking pants or hiking pants, like that kind of somewhat durable, I'd assume polyester something, polyester and acrylic. It's like the guide pants, but they're more stretchy and then have fleece on the inside.
I want some.
I know, right?
Yeah. I think Eddie Bauer keeps on having these sales. That's the only reason I was able to justify buying that nice of gear, but I'm very pleased. It was worth the money.
Well, thanks again, guys. Who wants to close this off with the awkward ending? I guess that's it. Thanks for joining us. All this river's looking fine. Gonna float me into state of mind. I'm on the challenge.